Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is August 6, 2020, and this is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm here to discuss the state of our currencies. We did the original audio for the state of our currencies in 2019 when I published the second quarter 2019 wrap-up, and we focused on the U.S. dollar dangerous and dominant and the de-dollarization that had been occurring in 2019. Events accelerated, and as they accelerated, the transition from the dollar as reserve currency to a whole new system in the global reset accelerated it. And I've been watching it, researching it, trying to understand, and delaying the write-up until we had a clear picture of what was going on, which is why tonight's discussion is called Take Two. So we did the audio when we originally published in 2019, and this is Take Two. The final written presentation is up on the web presentation at currency.soleri.com. I strongly recommend that you read this. The theme is at currency.soleri.com/currency. And you will find there the written analysis as well as a bibliography, a long chronology on the web presentation. When we make the PDF and hard copy, it'll be an abridged chronology, and there's lots of chronological information in the theme text. Then a section on movies and documentaries, also the Food for the Soul. Nina Hein wrote a wonderful piece on money lenders in art throughout the ages. Anyway, so there's a whole section there, and I strongly recommend you review and explore it. And it's extremely important to me that our subscribers avail themselves of this analysis. We are going through a period of enormous change, and the train has left the station. The central bankers have launched their reset, and they're not going to turn back. They're going to plow ahead. It doesn't matter how many millions of people get killed or thrown under the bus. We're in a global invention room. And when things are this fluid at the top, they can get wildly chaotic, sort of at the middle and the bottom. That means wherever you are, whatever your industries that you work or work around, or jurisdictions in which you live, and where you're subject to laws and regulatory compliance, what it means is that we're in a state of real, it's going to be impossible to predict what happens. Even the people running this can't predict what happens. And what that means is you need to understand, you need to have a framework for what's going on. And so as things evolve and they bob and weave, if you have that framework and you understand the trends that are upon us, the news can make sense, especially if you're checking back in with us on the weekly interviews in Money and Markets. And we can get in the business of being part of this invention room and having a say in how it goes, as opposed to just getting surprised and steamrolled. But I think if you have the framework of the change in the governance and economic models, and going from currency to the end of currency is what they're going to try. Let's hope they don't succeed. But if you have this kind of framework, it can really help you understand what's going on. Now, for us, a subscriber who's followed a lot of our content over the last 5 years, this analysis is going to be relatively easy for you to understand. If you're new and you haven't gone back and digested and understood the different pieces, this is highly integrative. And that means it's going to be to your benefit to go back and pick up the different pieces. So please don't feel that you have to digest this quickly. Take the time it takes to digest the different pieces, to put the different pieces together, and then to look at them, see if you can apply that framework in the context of the jurisdictions in which you live, or the industries in which you work, and keep feeding back. Let's keep discussing this at the Soleri Report, because again, our job is to make sure you have actionable intelligence. I want to make sure you have the framework and the intelligence you need to navigate a completely unpredictable, uncertain, and out of control environment. Anyway, if whether because you haven't digested earlier Soleri material, or you're not used to a lot of the terms that we would use in a discussion of the financial system and the economy, don't worry. Just take this one chapter at a time, read, research the background, and digest. As I said, I'm just going to go through the chapters, starting with the first one, Salieri Report Resources. There are many building blocks in our library and archives that will help you understand what's happening in the currency, and I list them in the first chapter. And again, you know, if it makes sense for you, go back and listen to those different pieces. For example, the pieces on technocracy, the pieces on secrecy. One of the hardest things for most people to fathom is that this situation grew up on them and surprised them, but it's been building for many years. And if you understand, Amy Benjamin did a great interview with us on secrecy. If you understand how the secrecy has worked, you'll understand how you got surprised if you feel that you were surprised. Patrick Wood has done a series on technocracy and including opportunity zones that is invaluable because we're moving from using currencies in a market-based economy to a technocracy where essentially it's we end currencies for the general population. And so understanding technocracy and the history of technocracy and how it evolved and its role as a resource allocation and moving the human from a sovereign individual to just another resource to be harvested. There are many, many building blocks. Two other very important building blocks are our work on space and the role of space, particularly space and the orbital platform as a mechanism to control what's going on the planet. And that competition in space is now going to a whole new level. And in addition, we did a great interview in 2014 with Stephen Roche. I can't recommend his book Unbalanced enough about the rebalancing of the China trade. Space and the rebalancing of our relationship with China in the West is a major part of what is going on. The Chinese, if anybody, really brought the de-dollarization issue to a head, both with their desire to build out global liquidity for their currency and their work with Russia to de-dollarize and their leadership in the BRICS to de-dollarize, but also in their incredible success with Huawei and 5G and tech that really challenges the kind of dominance the West needs to maintain a reserve currency. The challenge for the central bankers is how are they going to take the enormous asset bubble they've blown over the last 20 years and migrate that bubble to a new system. And it's one of the reasons they want very tight control of the population, because if you're managing people who are going from a per capita income of $65,000 to anywhere from 40% to 80% drop in their per capita income, you know, central bankers want to have very tight control. I had a very interesting discussion with Dr. Skidmore, which we'll publish next week. And in it, I said, I thought, for example, in the United States, the goal was to drop the per capita income from 65,000 to 15,000. And Dr. Skidmore said, that's about an 80% drop. I was expecting about a 40% drop. And I said, well, if you applied it fairly across the population, you know, it might be a 40% drop, but why do you think they'll apply it fairly? They're going to centralize more resources as they go. And one of the reasons I talked about the missing money was the importance of using that as leverage to do everything we could to make sure it's 40%, not 80%. Many commentators have always talked about a global reset as though it was a markdown of the debt. So we blow asset bubbles by blowing this extraordinary debt. We then mark down the debt. Everything crashes, and then you go back to a market economy with prices in the same framework. That's not what is being conceived of. What's being conceived of is a dramatic reengineering of the governance and economic systems, a dramatic reduction of resource use by the general population. And part of that is because if you're going to rebalance the China trade, then the China trade is no longer able to sort of levitate the false prosperity of the American population. So part of the 65,000, you know, whether it's a 40% drop or an 80% drop, is that per capita income was levitated by the China trade. And China's not willing to provide that subsidy any longer. The first chapter is the Salieri Report Resources. The second is the introduction, where I talk about this transition between two systems. And it's important to understand that I see the system that they're driving for as a return to slavery. Now, some people would say we're in a modified slavery system anyway. Nothing like what we're talking about. If you're talking about chipping somebody, whether nanotechnology or an implant or brain-machine interface, and the kind of mind control we're watching to sell and use the pandemic, you know, this is a return to slavery. And it's a model where the human being is very, very debased. I had one wonderful discussion with a subscriber who said, you know, we've gone from being a defined human to an animal, and now they're trying to turn us from an animal to a vegetable. Now, my vision is we reject the vegetable and go back to the divine human. And I think it's fair to say everybody listening to this shares that general direction. And the question, of course, is how? But that's the framework, global reset, and we're in a transition. That transition is going to take years. So get ready for rock and roll for a long, long time. This, I think the first phase of this could definitely be 3 to 5 years, and that's why you hear a variety of people with respect to COVID-19 talking about this is going to take many, many years. That's because COVID-19 and the sort of World Economic Forum global reset is the marketing strategy and the air cover for, in fact, a fundamental change by the central bankers and how the governance and economy is managed. The third chapter is governance structure, who's in charge. I keep coming back to this on the Salieri Report at every wrap-up. The most important unanswered question of our time is, who's really in charge? And is the Earth an open or closed economy? We don't know. I will say that one of the primary goals of the current governance structure is to become a multiplanetary civilization. And for those of you who've read our work on space, you know I believe the reason we globalized in the 90s was to create the capacity in Asia that we need to become a multiplanetary civilization on very high speed. So clearly one of the pushes for a global central bank that clearly you have the BIS, which is the central bank of central banks and is an association, if you will, of central banks. But what we're building towards is a much more centrally controlled and more powerful central bank. And that's because if you're going to interact off planet, if you're going to have colonies on Mars, if you're going to have colonies on the moon, you need a central coordinating point. And that's part of the push for a one world government and a one world central bank. Another reason we're centralizing is the technology makes it possible. And the technology that really makes it possible is the mind control. It's been, for anybody who's watched the COVID-19 sort of PSYOP carefully, it's been a remarkably successful. The unanswered question of who's really, you know, I use a nickname for the person who runs the planet, Mr. Global, but is Mr. Global human? Is Mr. Global interdimensional? Is Mr. Global, you know, have treaty obligations or owe a dividend to somebody off planet? This is the question. It makes the analysis tricky, and you'll see as you read it, particularly towards the end. Now, one of the things I say about any system, let me just mention another reason there's a push for an integrated global system is there is a great desire by the central bankers and the banking system to bring in all 7 billion people globally, and that means much lower transaction fees. If you look at the transaction fees in the West, there's no way you can bring the frontier and emerging markets in those transaction fees. So the desire to use technology to lower those transaction fees and to bring everybody into an integrated system is very, very strong. When you think about the governance system, it's extremely important to understand that a currency system or any financial transaction system is just a subset of the governance system, and you can't invent, design, or think about the currency or the financial transactions without it being an intimate part of the governance structure. So to talk about and design or change currency systems without understanding what it means to governance is sort of an insane act, which is why I always get frustrated when people try and persuade me to redesign the currency system without being able to answer who's really in charge. And I give several examples in the text of how what sounds like a great idea, a debt jubilee or a gold standard, could in fact make the governance situation much worse. So make Mr. Global much more powerful on a centralized basis and wipe us out. And I gave those examples because I hear so many proposals that are made on the basis of financial ideology without any understanding of the practical implications to political power on planet Earth. So again, it's very important for me that you think about the governance structure and you see all of these things in the financial system, including the currency system, as just tools within the governance structure. You want to think about it on a very integrated basis. Chapter number 4, I go through the U.S. dollar dominant and dangerous. I've spent 2 decades hearing that we're about to lose the reserve currency and warning people that we weren't. And the dollar throughout that period has gotten stronger. And a lot of the reasons it's gotten stronger, for example, if you look at the financial coup d'etat, which is all the securities fraud and the effort to basically move money out of the industrial economy into a new system and leave the retirement liabilities behind. I've always said they wanted the money for space and new technology, and they wanted to take all the retirement promises and healthcare promises they'd made to the boomer generation, leave them in the old economy so that, you know, the money's in the new economy, the liabilities in the old economy, and then you say, oh, well, there's no money, and I guess we're going to have to go bankrupt and write down all the, you know, abrogate all the contracts. One of the reasons I've been jumping up and down for 30 years is basically as I watch the assets get transferred out of the system that had the retirement obligations, what I was trying to warn people of is it's a neat trick. You'll see people do it with companies. So if your debt and your retirement obligations are in one company and you move all the assets to the second company and then you bankrupt the first company, you know what that means to the people who own the debt or the retirees. Anyway, so the U.S. dollar has engineered, or the syndicate that runs the U.S. dollar has engineered the financial coup, and that financial coup has made them much more powerful in terms of both managing the dollar, preserving it as a reserve currency, and putting the assets into a situation that makes them much stronger. Now we're in the end game, which is, of course, how are we going to manage the liabilities, whether it's the debt or the retirement, which are sort of stuck in the old system with far fewer assets. I talked a lot about the history of the dollar, how the dollar became the reserve currency, what it takes to be a reserve currency in the State of Our Currencies Take One, which was the audio that I did in December 2019. It's linked from the commentary. And if you want to go deep into the history of the dollar, how it became so dominant and dangerous, what makes a great reserve currency, I would recommend you go back and listen to that. There's no doubt that the de-dollarization has picked up strongly in 2018 and 2019. Jason Worth and I both read a wonderful book on de-dollarization that we did a review of, and I also did a review on the central banking, a history of central banking, and I recommend those both to you if you want to go into the history in a deeper way, both of the de-dollarization and the history of central banking. Chapter 5 is on the rise of China and too much debt. What happened in the financial crisis, we wrote off and stuck to the taxpayers a huge amount of fraudulent debt or sort of squiggly debt that had been sold domestically and globally. And we kept the economy going by China and the emerging markets leveraging up. And the result is around the world, there's way too much debt. And part of doing that was basically putting the world in a dollar bear trap. So you lend huge amounts of money in dollars, people borrow dollars all around the world, and then you come into something like COVID-19 where you slam down incomes, but meantime, their need for dollar and dollar to pay their debts continues. And so what happened was, one, we put the after the financial crisis, the emerging markets in China very significantly ballooned their debt. But the other thing that happened is China's growth rate continued to be strong, and their leadership in technology was very, very significant. And if you look at where they've come in quantum computing, AI, satellite technology, they've got their GPS satellites up now, their ability to sort of build out a navy, their ability to do 5G, they've come on as an independent force much faster than many in the West expected. And I'm still shocked that many in the West didn't understand that that was going to happen. You kind of wonder how the United States got itself into the box that it's in, but that's another question for another day. Anyway, one of the things I talk about is the extent to which China has done a phenomenal job of identifying, in terms of technology, in terms of space, in terms of military, in terms of cyber warfare capacity, and what I call the financial bazooka, global liquidity, all the different pieces you need to build out more liquidity on your currency and more lending power on your banking to start to build out your ability to perform as one of the five reserve currencies. China's done a remarkable job, and there's no doubt that we've now entered into a period of win-lose competition. And so I go into that in Chapter 5 and refer a lot to a wrap-up we did called The Rise of the Asian Consumer, which I strongly recommend. I was very shocked when I published it several years ago that many of our subscribers did not understand the extent to which China was expected in terms of GDP and many different components of sort of the power equation to surpass the United States relatively quickly. Of course, if Huawei and 5G China system had been successful globally, it would have gotten faster and very much more interesting. Chapter 6 is Space, the National Security State, Secrecy, and Privatization. And China and space are very much two sides of the same coin. The interesting thing about dominating in space is if you dominate in space, whoever dominates in space can dominate the entire planet. You know, for a long time, America was the only country with a GPS global space satellite constellation up. Now we have Europe with theirs. First, Russia got theirs in 2011. And just this last year or two, Europe and China have gotten theirs up. And so we truly are in a multipolar world. But the likelihood of intense space race between China and the United States is very, very real. And it wouldn't surprise me if many of the things we're watching, including COVID-19, quote-unquote pandemic, is to do everything we can to put China in a dollar bear trap and tighten up their ability to spend money on their navy, i.e. South China Sea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, as well as in space. Space is going to be unbelievably important to the kinds of activities we're talking about in terms of building out the utility grid and the train tracks you need to do a global currency, as well as many of the other global technologies that are possible here, including energy. The kinds of financial transaction system we're talking about are huge energy hogs. And it's one of the reasons I've always believed if they're going to do a crypto system, and again, I don't think of crypto as a currency, I think of it as a control system. But if they're going to do crypto, then the question is, where are they going to get the energy from? Clearly, stopping all of us from commuting and staying home and working from home saves some energy. But I think ultimately, one of the goals of having a complete control system of the kind they're contemplating is it allows you to bring out breakthrough energy, which I believe they've had for plus 100 years. Clearly, the national security state and the extraordinary secrecy that's been going on is critical to what's been happening, and you can't understand what has happened over the last 20 years, let alone where we're going in terms of the end of currencies and the institution of a global control grid, without understanding how the secrecy got this bad. And a very big piece of it, you know, the nut that went in place that made the global reset possible was FASB 56. Dr. Skidmore and I spent a lot of time talking and writing about FASB 56 and what it means. But what it means is you don't need Epstein and the Clintons anymore. You can run all organized crime directly through the Fed and Treasury accounts, unfortunately. Part of this is privatization, and if you look at what is coming in terms of radical reengineering of the U.S. government and some government systems, even a lot more can be outsourced to private corporations. And of course, that makes secrecy even more possible. One of the great drivers of secrecy has been turning over government operations to corporations, and not on an economic basis. So this is generally, the privatization has been very expensive and uneconomic for the taxpayer, and is really an enormous subsidy of the corporate infrastructure. And unfortunately, that has built a corporate infrastructure which is extremely inefficient and uneconomic. Okay, so as I said, Chapter 6 was Space, the National Security State, Secrecy, and Privatization. We've done a lot on the Saleri Report to help you understand how the National Security State has evolved and how that relates to the economy. If you haven't digested that information, I would really encourage you to go back and do it. And I describe some of the key Saleri reports to do that with, in both in the first chapter and chapter 6. Chapter 7 is on the Internet of Things. I call it the Internet of Things Gold Rush, Land and Real Estate, and the Final Mile. If you're going to run a railroad across the United States, you have to build the train tracks from New York to San Francisco, right? It's the same with the Internet of Things. You have to basically get a chip and everything. And what we're watching with the smart grid, smart cities, smart meters, smartphones, you're talking about building out the train tracks in every community, in every home on the planet, to basically create an infrastructure where all equipment, all things can talk to each other, so you can have driverless cars and dramatically reduce many different expenses. So Amazon can ship you your goods by drone instead of shipping your goods through the post office or through FedEx. And in a world where energy is extremely cheap, that could be highly, highly economic. The electromagnetic pollution of this vision is a nightmare. One of the book reviews we just published this year is Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg. And one of my concerns is the pandemic is air cover for the kind of sickness and death and disability that's going to be brought on by 5G. And I would really encourage you to read Invisible Rainbow. It's an extraordinary book and it will give you a very valuable perspective. It's interesting, the viruses and sort of the magic, call COVID-19 the magic virus because it can do anything the deep state needs it to do. Viruses and germs have been used as an excuse for a lot of electrification sickness, and Furstenberg does a very good job of documenting it. Now, the Internet of Things is being sold as something that's going to bring great consumer delight and convenience and time saving. You know, in my reality, it brings the opposite. First of all, it brings surveillance capitalism. That's what it's been bringing for two decades. But the reality of what the Internet of Things is going to look like is the kind of rioting and looting we've seen to redevelop Minneapolis. If you haven't read our commentary on the redevelopment patterns in Minneapolis related to the looting, I would do it. So it's rioting, looting to basically steal people's real estate. It's fires in Paradise, California, because somebody wants the land and they're happy to burn out 50,000 people. It's why I recommended the TV series Yellowstone. Yellowstone is about land wars. And Yellowstone is a much more, it's clearly a very graphic description, but I think it's a much more accurate description of the change in values and the grab for other people's real estate and land that is going on, has been going on for several years now and is going to continue. I describe in Chapter 7 why I think all the different developments, and crypto is a part of it, is part of a big push to control land and real estate. When you bring the energy price down, and again, my theory is they're going to bring it down with Breakthrough Energy once they get the control grid in place. But if you can bring energy down, the question is, how do you make money on it? And the way you make money on it is by owning the assets that experience a radical reduction in cost structure, whether manufacturing or real estate. So I think part of the real estate and land grab is implementing the smart cities, but it's also taking advantage of the enormous capital gains that can come from a big drop in the energy costs. Chapter 8 is the financial transhumanism and the final inch. Unfortunately, the building out of the smart grid is envisioned to go all the way into not just our electromagnetic bodies, but into our physical bodies. Whether that's going to be done with nanotechnology in the injections or brain-machine interfaces in the injections or chips that are implanted, there are many different kinds of technologies that are being played with and prototyped. We have in the currency theme in the write-up, we have a article that Jason Worth did for us called Glossary of Human Ingestibles and Injectables, and he's been updating a database we have in the news trends and stories section called Dr. Gates Creepy Technology, named that because the Gates Foundation is financing all of it. If you dive in and you look at all the different technology they're trying, you know, which includes putting vaccines in our tomatoes or spraying it over our heads, it is a very wide body of prototypes. And again, remember, we left the train, we're in the reset, but everything is being prototyped. So it's very, very fluid. And you're going to prototype 100 technologies before you try 10 and settle on one or two. This could go many ways. I'm convinced, in addition to the 5G killing millions of people, I'm convinced that the injections are going to kill, I call them toxins, are going to kill, disable, and poison many more millions. Remember, they're trying to roll them out with, number one, complete corporate liability indemnification. So corporations have no liability. So they can kill a million people. Nobody has to pay. Number one. Number two, we now have, the U.S. government has now spent $10 billion, other governments more, to pay these vaccine companies to make vaccines. And as they do, so imagine the business model. Somebody pays all your costs to create the product. Somebody mandates a market for you, and then they free you of all liability. It's like a money machine. It's impossible to lose money. So we see Kodak, Tesla, and numerous entrepreneurs and companies that have zero experience in health science or injections or toxins or vaccines jumping in and declaring themselves, you know, they're now a toxin maker. Make no mistake about it, these injections have killed millions, disabled millions, poisoned millions. Now, if you introduce injections that have not been through years of human trials and quality control under circumstances where the corporations have been paid to develop them and have no legal liability, and you roll them out with 5G, which also, if you look at the history of electrification, has the ability to make a lot of people sick or kill a lot of people. If you do these two things at the same time, I can understand why you would want people to think that there's a dangerous pandemic going on, because you're going to make so many people sick or kill so many people that you need a cover story. You can't just say we've stolen $60 trillion, so now we're basically going to do a coup d'etat and lower your income 40 to 80% a year. And what we're also going to do is we're going to institute these injections and 5G, which is going to kill and disable many of you, including your children, and that's, we're just going to do that. You can't just say that. So you have to say, oh no, there's a virus and we're trying to save you from it, protect you from it, and we have contract tracers to help you. It's an ugly picture, but I want you to look at it early and understand it, because that's our best chance of working around it, navigating it, stopping it. One of the things that it's important for you to think about is, if humans can be communicated with and managed by AI that are also managing and communicating with robots, then the education of the robots by the humans through the AI can go much faster, much more efficiently. And if you can use the same labor taxation and communication systems to manage both populations, you're going to save a fantastic amount of money. And so if you look at this system that I'm describing from Mr. Global's point of view, and you start to think through the challenges of managing robots and humans separately within the labor force, you can see why Mr. Global is pushing for an integrated system. I've talked a lot with Dr. Farrell about why I think a lot of the transgender and LGBT rights issues have nothing to do with what they sound like literally. They really are about getting the labor, taxation, and all systems integrated between robotics and humans as labor. Again, a dark picture, but it helps you make sense of what otherwise looks like. Why are so many very wealthy, powerful people financing these ridiculous sort of movements? In Chapter 9, I dive into currency and the going direct global reset. What you saw was 2019 was really a turning point for the global consensus about the dollar. Nothing could threaten the sort of dangerous and dominant dollar system unless you started to put together the institutional mechanisms to provide serious liquidity away. And we started to see in 2018 and 2019 the BRIC nations finally begin to do that. They've been working towards it for more than a decade, but it finally started to come together. In the meantime, G7 and the BIS and the Swiss, along with the Fed, were working to finally come together and build the global firepower you needed to put together something at a global central bank level, including using crypto. And I walk through, in Chapter 9, I walk through the chronology and some of the key dates. Of course, one of the most important key dates is the central bank meeting in Jackson Hole in August 2019, where we know this thanks to Pam and Russ Martins, who really deserve a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of this. The going direct plan was approved as a financial bailout plan by the G7 central bankers together. It was designed by a group of former central bankers who were on the BlackRock payroll, and that includes Stanley Fischer, who's the former vice chairman of the Fed, and he was also the chairman of the Israeli Central Bank. The Israelis are clearly outpunching their weight in the going direct plan and many of the events that are driving it. Now, that meeting in Jackson Hole occurred right after the Bohemian Grove meeting, which is a meeting which would have reviewed and approved whatever was going on at Jackson Hole. And that came after the G7 got together and approved their sort of framework for crypto. So these are very significant events. And right after that, right after the Jackson Hole meeting, the Fed goes into the repo market and starts the process of buying the world. And as we've been covering with John Titus on Money and Markets, we proceeded to see in a very short period of time, the Fed basically prints more money than they had in the 3 to 5 years during the financial crisis period. So, you know, this is quantitative easing on steroids. And many commentators who believe in the idea of the write down the debt reset kept thinking, oh, well, the Fed's losing control and the system's going under. No, the system's being re-engineered, and the re-engineering is being led by the global bankers. And the thing to understand about what makes this different is G7 plus the Bank of International Settlements plus the Swiss National Bank plus the Fed, all of them together, that's the firepower you need to build a global central bank, particularly the financial bazooka. If you go back and look at the characteristics at the beginning of the currency write-up where I describe the key characteristics of a successful reserve currency, you've got to have that financial bazooka. And when you put the Bank of International Settlements and the Swiss National Bank and the Fed and the G7 together, including the ECB, pow. You've got what you need. You've also got the power you need to put China back in the box or isolate them into a separate system if that's the way it goes. Now, it's very interesting. Just as I finished up the write-up on July 22nd, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of the leading banking regulators in the U.S., authorized a bank by a letter to hold and provide services for crypto. And my prediction is the next thing we'll see now is the Senate and the House, particularly if we get a change in parties after the election, will authorize a universal basic income using those crypto train tracks. But this will be a crypto under tight control of the central banks, and it will be on the way to either a central global crypto or different cryptos within the different zones that easily, from a payment and trading standpoint, integrate up into a global one. I took a lot of the dates out of the chronology for 2019, so you could see how quickly things are moving. And when you look at what is happening in the COVID-19 pandemic through the eyes of what the central bankers are up to, what you realize is it's just a marketing scheme for the reset. It's phenomenal. And, you know, I have to say it's done a phenomenal job of marketing the reset. If you told people that, oh, you know, we're going to lower your annual income, well, just take New York. As of 2 months ago, 100,000 businesses in New York, small businesses, had gone bankrupt or been destroyed and shut down. I mean, if you're going to say, oh, we're going to do a global reset and shut down all your small businesses and bankrupt you and throw you into a debt entrapment, you know, and reduce you to poverty, can you imagine what people would have said after having lived through the financial crisis? They'd say, no, I don't think so. And literally, Jim Cramer has called this the greatest wealth transfer in the history of, I think, Western civilization or civilization. So we've literally seen the U.S. billionaires go up in net worth as of a month ago by over 20%. That's over $500 billion. So it's extraordinary. And yet they've been successful both with the mind control and sort of selling this as a pandemic at literally getting an enormous number of people to go along and believe that there's a real pandemic. It's quite extraordinary. And I'm not saying that they're not using chemical or biological warfare or EMF warfare, that where pathogens can be turned on and off. So, but if you look at the marketing effort of a global reset using a pandemic, I hate to say, so far it's been remarkably successful. Chapter 10 is Crypto Transaction Systems, Institutional and Retail Challenges. It's phenomenally interesting to me that the central bankers have proceeded on a plan and they're making it up as they go. And certainly I understand why that's the case, but it is a phenomenal thing to manage, to turn the entire financial system of an entire planet into an invention room and just be making it up as you go. It's quite extraordinary. In chapter 10, I go through some of the challenges. Now, I listed out the ones that they have described. The Basel Committee at the BIS invited comments on the design of a prudential treatment for crypto assets. And sort of I wrote out the issues of, you know, is it sovereign, is it private? Are the central banks direct or are they intermediaries? What do they do about deposit insurance, different functions, technology, laws and taxation? What are the capital requirements? Those are all the sort of official reality or overt issues, very important issues and very tricky, difficult issues. So I list them there. And of course, you can link to the BIS paper. But here are some of the real challenging, and it's important to realize how difficult some of these things are if you were sitting on the committee trying to figure this out. One is you've got to kill cash. So, and you can tell from all the different things they're doing, they're trying very hard to kill cash. And the big corporations are making a ton of money, because if you're Walmart, you come in and pay $19 or you buy $19.10 of vegetables, and then I refuse to give you 90 cents change. I get to keep the 90 cents. You can imagine if you're Walmart, you're making billions and billions from that. So they've decided to kill cash, but in a way that makes the pro-centralization team a huge amount of money. The second is organized crime. The central banks have always had a bit of a dance, because the only organized crime that can function on any kind of size are ones that can use the banking system. And so it's always been tightly controlled by the central banks, really. But they've always had quite a dance of being able to put themselves, you know, we didn't know it was very complex. So, you know, money laundering, we need more control. You know, they've always had an excuse. It's going to be very difficult in something that is this centrally controlled to explain how we have a GDP for transnational organized crime that's the same size of Germany or Japan. So part of their question is, how do they manage organized crime and pretend they're not doing it? Rebalancing the China trade. Is China going to come into the G7 box, or are they going to have a separate internet, separate payment systems, and how's the fight in space going to work? Multiplanetary transactions, big question. Are we an open economy or are we a closed economy? The U.S. government just put out a new scope of work for a corporation or contractor to help them design how they build nuclear power plants on Mars and Moon. So, you know, we're going to have a mechanism if there's a colony on Mars to transact back and forth. Same with the Moon. Vodafone and Nokia have been hired to install a 4G network. That contract got let in 2018. Transhumanism is a very gruesome part of all of this. And so if you're going to have, I call them injectable credit cards, how is the mechanisms going to work and how are you going to handle the branding problems? I think if central banks have a bad name for themselves, they're really going to have a bad name after this is over if they succeed. Now, they seem to have left the gruesome parts of transhumanism to the tech industry and big pharma, but the reality is the central banks are running this, and so it's going to be interesting to see how they handle the hatred that rolls off of transhumanism. Maybe they think the mind control can work all the way. We'll see. It's interesting. I point out here that Google has announced that it wants all of its employees to work from home. As you know, I think the reason Harvard Endowment outsourced a lot, fired a lot of their in-house staff, is the extent of the disaster capitalism and the gruesome things going on. They didn't want knowledgeable, well-educated Harvard graduates working for them to see how they were making money. If they're a big real estate investor in something like the Minneapolis Opportunity Zone, they don't want their employees getting a gander of what they're really up to. I think Google is one of the leaders with Apple, unfortunately, on the contact tracing app. I think, given what's really going to go on under contract tracing, Google does not want their employees to know what they're really up to. And so they want everybody staying home where they can, you know, be kept on a need-to-know basis. They don't want anybody figuring out what's going on, let alone telling Project Veritas. You know, part of this, everybody stays at home and can't figure out what's going on, has to do with implementing policies that are absolutely not acceptable to the average citizen of a G7 nation. The next big problem, and this is really amazing, we are building an entire global infrastructure based on the internet where there's essentially no regulation, no enforcement, and it's becoming a platform for cyber warfare. If I told you how much time and money we spend on dealing with hackers and denial of service attacks, this is the Wild West. The cyber world is a Wild West world. And I would say all of these systems and the tech industry have zero integrity. I mean, the tech industry grew on surveillance capitalism, not on providing systems or software that really worked. So I think, how do you build a series of global cryptocurrencies, again, I don't call them currencies, crypto systems that have integrity when your fundamental systems have no integrity? How's that supposed to work? This has baffled me for decades, but I think this is far from come to a head, and I think it's one of the reasons that the chances of failure are very real. You know, I use the word in here, cluster, you know what. I think we're headed to a huge cluster, you know what, because you cannot build something this powerful on zero integrity systems. Another obstacle is the psychic storm. If you bring in 7 billion people, so say you've got 3 to 4 billion people on smartphones in the psychic storm of the internet, now you're going to bring in all 7 billion, and that's an awful lot of sort of psychic and spiritual energy to bring in, and who knows what it will do. Now, the people running the system are serious hypermaterialists, and I don't think they understand what it means to bring in that kind of, you know, I'm reminded of Michael Ventura, who said, we're standing in the storm of our own being, the psychic storm of our own being. Usury and negative interest rates. The United States really started to go bad when it legalized usury in the 1990s. Of course, the games with negative interest rates are, of course, frightening, especially if you have everybody on a financial control grid. The possibilities of, well, it's a slavery system. What can I say? But the financial ramifications of that slavery system could get very, very ugly. And I'm assuming that's part of, depending on the entrainment, the mind control, the subliminal programming, the propaganda. But if you look at the extent to which we're depending on those things, I think the blowback and unintended consequences in the field, we're still herd animals, we're still field animals, could be great. Energy, I discussed. Crypto is phenomenally energy expensive. How are we going to get from here to there as an energy matter? That's why I always laugh when they talk about climate change. Really? So as you can see, whether it's the nuts and bolts mechanics or the bigger picture obstacles, the obstacles are enormous. And it's one of the reasons I think a lot can go wrong, which is going to make for a very chaotic environment for all of us, why we need to be able to rock and roll. But I also think these efforts can fail and fail spectacularly. And to me, the most difficult part of what the central banks are trying to do is they're trying to build a system and implement a system which is in violation of life. And so when you build a financial or economic system which is in alignment with life, it can go faster, it can fix its own mistakes, it can learn, it can evolve, but you have the support of being supported by life and being in alignment with life. When you do something that is this contradictory to life, which brings slavery, which brings the end of freedom, which brings the end of imagination and mind, you know, you're bringing death and you don't have life supporting you. If you've ever watched The Lord of Rings and seen the trees jump into the fight, you know what I'm talking about. But I really believe that all living creatures and the divine intelligence are in cahoots. And when you try to do something which is in defiance of the divine intelligence, in defiance of the plant intelligence, the animal intelligence, the human intelligence, when you defy the impulse of nature and life, you just have a constant energetic war on your hands, which is why I think it's so important you learn about the friction of war, because we are going to be feeling the friction of war like nothing else when you do something that is this in violation and contradictory of the living model. Now, we've had an economic model that is based on the machine model, and it's one of the reasons the financial system has been much more energy wasteful and much more painful and difficult to manage than it had to be. It's one of the reasons I recommended that wonderful video of Rupert Sheldrake talking about the machine model versus the living model. What the central bankers are doing are doubling down on the machine model and literally trying to get the machine into our bodies and heads. And if you know anything about the history of heavy metals poisoning, what you know, Reed Forrest Moretti does a genius job of explaining it in four books, which we've reviewed this year. The machines just don't integrate into the human body. And I know the transhumanists think they're going to make it happen and try, but this is anti-life. So life, this is a tsunami of the machine model coming towards life and life coming towards the machine model. And it's going to be quite a cluster, you know what, when it sort of, when the two tsunamis explode against each other. And that's, I think, one of the reasons, again, you want pandemic as an air cover, because you're going to have a lot of deaths, a lot of sickness, a lot of disability in the process. And the question is, how are you going to manage it? I say life wins. The history of the planet is life always wins, but I don't underestimate the danger of this time. Chapter 11 is called Life in the Global Reset Invention Room. Anytime you shuffle the deck at the very top, the reverberation in the middle and the bottom can be extraordinary, and the breakdown of all the systems that have provided the risk management can go with it. and the nature of the change can implode many of the different companies, institutions, peoples that you depend on. The shadow work, if you haven't read my piece on shadow work, you might want to check it out. The shadow work explodes, and the uncertainty and the unpredictability explodes. Two of the quotes I use in the chapter 11 is one of my favorite from the Buddha: those who are awake live in a state of constant amazement. And we will spend our days for the next couple of years at least in a state of constant amazement. Another one is from Albert Einstein: technological progress is like an axe in the hands of a pathological criminal. And unfortunately, we're going to be seeing a lot of things, we're seeing them now, that remind us of a pathological criminal, because you have a group of very wealthy, powerful people, companies, and agencies who can kill and steal with impunity, and they are very, very emboldened by what has happened over the last 20 years. And they have a very hyper-materialist vision of what is possible and how the world works. Our opportunity is that this change is in the invention room. And that means whether Mr. Global likes it or not, and whether you like it or not, you have a say in how it goes. And I think step one is to reject the notion that we should become a vegetable. Step one is to say, no, I'm a divine human. I'm not an animal. I certainly have aspects of being an animal, but I'm a divine human. And I can access the intelligence of the divine and the intelligence of all life. And I can build a life and an economic model which is based on life and giving life. One of my favorite videos of the COVID-19 experience was the wonderful doctor from Houston, Stella Emanuel, who was just interviewed on a Houston TV station. She was the doctor. She's originally from Cameroon. And I guess was her medical education started in Nigeria. She was one of the doctors, along with Dr. Simone Gold, who went to Washington and objected to many of the policies that are being implemented. One of them is Dr. Gold and Dr. Emanuel have had great success saving people from COVID with hydrochloroquine and are outraged that they should be pressured to stop using it since it's such a low-cost, economic, and relatively easy cure. And she just gave an interview, and the interviewer was really pressuring her and said, well, you know, if you keep doing this, if you keep healing people with hydrochloroquine, you could lose your license. And she understood the threat involved. I mean, it's really a cheap, dirty trick. And she said, really? How many people should I let die so I can keep my license? And it was a perfect example, you know, and she went back and forth with him. It's really a must-watch interview. But she went back and forth and back and forth with him. I've had 400 patients. They've all lived. Should I have let them die so I can have my license? Then she said, you know, you come and try and take my license because I don't let people die, and you're going to have a war. Great courage and fearlessness. And I think if we're going to live in the global reset invention room, there's only one way to live, and that's with great courage and fearlessness. We are looking at potential chaos. The tyranny just of what's being done during the COVID-19 pandemic is extraordinary. There is a rumor in Germany. I'm in Germany right now at Lake Constance, but local official involved in a city council was told by his mayor and municipality that they have been told to prepare for the next lockdown, which will be 3 to 6 months starting at the end of August. Is that true? I don't know. But that is a reasonable scenario. If you look at what's needed for a global reset, we are going to be in this process for at least 3 to 5 years, I would think, is the highly chaotic process. And then it'll take a decade to get any system stable. Now, to me, of course, the unanswered questions are very, very significant. And one of the things that could be wonderful during this period is if we can finally get transparency in the point of, is the economy on Earth open or closed? Number one. what's the speed at which we're going to become a multiplanetary civilization and why? And then can China adjust to being in the G7 umbrella? Are they going to focus on building an independent system? Or is the U.S. going to try and engineer a war with China? So the open and closed question is one of the big variables that drive the scenarios. And then, you know, whether we can find a way out of the win-lose position with China and how that gets resolved is another one. Either way, whether it's they're preserving the resources to build a multiplanetary civilization or the China trade is no longer there to, you know, sort of hold up Western prosperity, each one of us is going to be in a position of really having to embrace as high learning speed as possible about how to build economic resiliency under this situation, because the economic change in our personal lives is going to be extraordinary. And there's only one direction to go, and that's forward. There is no backward. And what you're trying to do is to re-engineer your balance sheet and your income and expense, your financial statement, ASAP, always trying to optimize, always trying to be useful, always trying to serve life in a way that makes you economically resilient. For everybody, it's different. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to me that you have the framework that I've presented in the State of Our Currencies, because if you have that framework and you understand it and you have access to the different component parts that we've tried to write up, publish, explain, then you will have an understanding of the trends and you will have an understanding of the framework. You can see the reset evolving and you can see how it works, and then you can rock and roll, you can navigate, you can bob and weave within your own particular situation. Chapter 12 is very short. It's the conclusion, and I posted the Red Button video. If you don't know the Red Button video or the Red Button story, I strongly recommend you watch it. We've had an opportunity for 30 years to push the red button, certainly in the United States, and we didn't. And it's one of the reasons if we fall in income, we have so far to fall. A great effort has been made for many, many decades to prop up our false prosperity. And we didn't have to go along with it, but we did. And it's one of the reasons we are politically and in terms of individual and human rights so in the corner in the United States. I would say it's nowhere near as people are nowhere near as much in the corner in Europe. But we've allowed Mr. Global during this period of false prosperity to empty out the storehouse. And now the boom is being lowered. So we didn't push the red button, and now Mr. Global has. And as I said, there's no way to do. The question before us is now, can we turn the red button green? Can we make money on the pushing of the red button? Because then we can adapt. And we can also have a say about changing this model away from slavery and more into life. I mean, I want the central bankers to fail, but I don't want the human race to fail. And so we have been an enormous beneficiary of financial liquidity. I am a lover of financial tools and financial liquidity. I think financial liquidity is the very part of the heartbeat of freedom. And so we're going to need financial liquidity, and we have the capacity to create that. We can create local stock markets. We can create local currencies. You know, we can do all of these things. We can create a more powerful liquidity than the central bankers have ever dreamed of. Because when you optimize bottom up without all of this enormous energy and financial waste of the top-down control, the wealth that can be created is absolutely mind-boggling. But it's going to take financial liquidity. And so if we want the central bankers to fail, then the question is, okay, how are we going to provide for that financial liquidity? It can be done, but it requires great courage and fearlessness. And you have to stay in a state of amusement. Sometimes people get angry at me for laughing. You know, I talk about how these guys are going to try and depopulate us all, and then I laugh. Because you have to, if you're going to play to win in a situation that is this fluid and where there is this much evil sort of running around the planet, you have to approach it with courage and fearlessness, and that means we have to play to win. We have to maintain our state of amusement. If you're out of your state of amusement, I truly recommend you go watch all the videos of Dr. Stella Emanuel and Dr. Simone Gold telling Grouchy Fauci to go jump in a lake, etc. How many people should I let die so I can keep my license? I'll never forget. It was exactly what I said in Washington to somebody who's trying to persuade me to help HUD basically kill people with their budget. And I said, how many kids should go homeless and die so that we can keep our contract? And then I laughed. I had to say it several times. And finally, the person I was talking to looked at me and said, you're right. Why would I want to do this? I said, you know, it seems to me there's always something we can do that's better than becoming a desk killer. I finished the chapter 12, very short, with a quote from an article I wrote in 2006. A living history is not always a pretty picture. It is, however, a real one. When mastered, it starts the student on a journey of taking life with both hands to create something true and beautiful. Each of us can say, I'm a part of a great story, and that story is not over yet. I have something to say about how it goes. And that's what I believe. I believe if you look at how open and fluid this experiment is, I believe that each one of us has a say about how it goes. One of my favorite poems from Robert Penn Warren starts, tell me a story in this century and moment of madness. Tell me a story. Make it a story of great distances and starlight. And in fact, that's the question each one of us has to ask, whether it's what we envision, what we pray for, what we dream for, what we finance with our money, with our time, what we do to generate an income or be useful. What kind of world do we now create, and can we turn the red button green? And I think each one of us has a much bigger say about that than sometimes it feels like day to day to day. And if enough of us choose the divine human instead of reverting and becoming a vegetable, I don't know about you, but I don't feel like being a tomato, let alone one that's full of vaccines. So I think I'll go for divine human. As I always say, death is not the worst thing that can happen. Indeed, slavery is the worst thing that can happen. And unfortunately, that's what the central bankers have in plan for us. So let's surprise them, shall we? Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, state of our currencies. And, you know, I always close by saying, don't worry about if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. You know, but I can assure you, once you finish the state of your currencies, you will be absolutely sure that there is a conspiracy. There are plenty of them, and it's absolutely time for us to start our own conspiracies. That's what I did in 1998. It's called Solari. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.